Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky and disturbing children's books, films and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're joined by special guest Kat Burrows to talk about The Thief of Always by Clive Barker. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam, and welcome to our guest, Kat Burrows, totally unsuspicious person.
I am doing everything legal.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some things, but you know, I'm fine. I'm fine to have Kat on the podcast.
Thank you. Nothing has ever been proven.
Well, that's the main thing. That's our policy. Okay, so. Let's move on. We're talking about The Thief of Always today, as written by Clive Barker, another non-sus individual. Clive Barker, of course, of the Hellraiser series.
Yeah.
A thoroughly wholesome man.
We're not covering the Hellraiser films, however, on Still Scared. I hear there's a lot of them. Kat, have you actually watched quite a few of them?
A number. I mean, the first is just an outright good movie. The second probably has some of my favorite visuals ever. They get very, very silly, which I love. And then they get very, very bad, which I also kind of love. But then they've done them now, and now it's all really, really gory, and I'm too much of a wimp to actually watch any of the new ones.
I watched the first two in preparation for reading Clive Barker's children's books. I really enjoyed them.
I mean, I was surprised, Ren, because you're not always one for sort of squishy body horror. You can get the squick. And you said you really liked them.
Yeah, I don't know that, like, they, it maybe it helped that I was watching them. I was watching with a friend who kept talking about wet puppets, and that made me laugh.
It's good practical effects, and good practical effects are satisfying to watch.
Yeah, they're really good. They are really squishy and wet and glistening, but it's like, it's cool. It's like,
oh, yeah, they ruin some good outfits in the first one. Just ruin some clothes.
Yeah. So I haven't actually watched them. I've listened to some of the Evolution of Horror Pod episodes on them, so I must get round to them. I also likewise own the 2001 video game Clive Barker's Undying. Which again, I've not actually ever got round to. Did an FMV game as well, I think. Me and Ali have recently been playing our way through Sierra's Phantasmagoria, their notorious but wildly successful FMV game, which I have played before. So I'm kind of in the mood for actors having, well, not having to, but necessarily acting, maybe, in a very stilted way in front of green screen. So yeah, I'll be playing that soon as well.
Yeah.
Because I have to say, I loved this book. This is incredible.
Yeah. So Clive Barker, known for Hellraiser and the stories that they're based on, and it's also a director and an artist, and he also wrote and illustrated this children's horror novel, The Thief of Always, published in 1992, which I don't think is a widely known fact.
Yeah, who knew? Well, Kat did, so thank you,
yes. Yeah, me and Adam have been doing this podcast for a while, and we're quite familiar with children's horror, but neither of us had heard of this book.
and I met Kat when I was visiting my sibling Willow in London, and she said, "Oh, you should do The Thief of Always," and I was like, "Yeah." So,
so Kat, how did you discover it?
I was trying to remember this the other day, and I don't know. It sort of appeared on my radar in that way that things do. And I think I had a stepdad who was really into horror. I remember the Green Mile was coming out in serial form, like in these tiny little books, and he got all of them. So I suspect it must have come through him, and actually reading it, it would make sense, because I think Stephen King sort of like declared that Clive Barker was sort of like the new incredible scene, like the person on the horror scene. And there are some slight, you can see a little bit of echoes. I don't think Clive Barker was like directly inspired by it, but it did come out in like 1986. And it's another one of a, you know, children trying to deal with something overwhelmingly horrific and something that adults can't deal with. And I think my love for this book, because I loved it deeply, really set up kind of my later, like, finding Clive Barker's other work, finding Stephen King, and really enjoying, like, strong kids, especially, like, strong girl characters, which this book has. And yeah, kind of my life of reading good horror fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, this is like what I wanted Stranger Things to be, instead of the aggressively disappointing action CGI fest that stretched on for what felt like decades.
But you can't replicate the language. I mean, Clive Barker is one of those people that I think even, like, his language is so, and I guess I'll be the first one to say textured, like, that that honestly, like, it's, you don't need to imagine anything. It's going to be intrusively in your head. I didn't reread this book so much as I remembered it, and the words just sort of danced across my eyes to kind of prepare for this.
Yeah. What, I guess, yeah, what were your most, your strongest memories from reading it as a kid?
There are phrases in here that have just become part of, like, the things that I think, like, the great grey beast February, like, the first sentence is, you know, something like Harvey Swick was eaten alive by the great grey beast February, and I still think of that whole month like that, and the moment when, like, Mrs. Griffin sees him and goes, "Harvey Swick as I live and breathe," like, there are just things in here that I just I'd like have sense memories of, you know, the blue cat, like with the coat as sky blue in it, and the idea of, like, what the beetle and the worm getting into everything, like, there's just, he writes these fish hooks that just stick in your brain, and you just kind of grow up with them in there, and they become kind of these beautiful little piercings, which is works because Clive Barker is a, you know, is a progenitor of goths. Like, he makes goths. You read him and you become more goth, even if you're the least goth person in the world.
Yeah, that's a lovely description. Yeah.
And we've got the same covers, Kat, because as ever, I my webcam does not work on Discord, so you can't see me or my cover, but you kindly showed your book cover, and it's presumably the first edition. It's hardback, and it's got the house which Harvey is spirited away to, sort of glowing and illuminated, and then this sort of awful, like, serpentine face emerging from the foliage below the house.
Yes, and it's that copy has his illustrations all the way through, because it's one of the few books that he, Clive Barker is a good artist as well. And I love his illustrations. I was saying to Rin when I was gushing about this book, and they were very kindly listening to me just monologue, that I learned to draw by drawing the illustrations in this book. Like,
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're really good illustrations. Like, they're just black ink pen. I think like some of it sort of looks like brush pen. So again, textured. But sort of kind of scratchy and fluid at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, they are both compelling and grotesque, which is something that I love in my artwork. You know, I'm a big Aubrey Beardsley fan. And I love good horror art, you know. And there's actually, I went to a university during COVID and I was in Aberdeen, and they've got a surprisingly good art museum there. And they have a bust that Clive Barker did. And it's sort of representation of Francis Bacon, who's another fantastic horror artist. And I remember finding it and being like, this is the best thing in Aberdeen.
That's really cool.
Yeah, your cover's not quite
no,
as
my cover
as inspiring,
is a later edition, presumably. It's sort of it's very blue. It's got some little sparkly bits, and a boy sort of walking into a bright light, and his shadow, he has big sort of bat wings. Which is fine, but not as evocative.
Yeah, I'm quite excited to bring this edition into my new school, because I've got a new job. And yeah, I definitely want to put this on my bookshelf in my classroom. Mm.
So yeah, as Kat said, the first sentence is a real banger of an opening sentence. Which is that the great grey beast February had eaten Harvey Swick alive. Here he was, buried in the belly of that smothering month, wondering if he would ever find his way out through the cold coils that lay between here and Easter.
It's quite Dickensian.
It is, but it's also so like when it goes on and you know, he kind of posits this person wondering how Harvey had died, and then takes this he'd follow through the streets, he'd sit where Harvey would sit and be bored in this way, and then he would completely understand, and with tears in his eyes he would say that Harvey Swick was eaten by the great grey beast February. And as a very melodramatic only child, I definitely had like that series of thoughts of like, this is going to happen to me, and they'll wonder why, and then they'll totally understand that and they'll feel sorry for me, and they will think I was such a brave little soldier.
Harvey is bored, the weather is horrible. His mother tells him, don't sit wishing the days away, life too short. But he is. And a strange kind of scrawny, smiling figure sort of blows through his bedroom window and offers to take Harvey somewhere out of this world. His character is Rictus. And Harvey kind of agrees. Rictus comes back, and when Harvey agrees to go with him to Mr. Hood's holiday house. I think this, the way I was sort of thinking about kind of approaching this book is kind of through sort of different children's horror tropes, because it covers quite a lot of them that we've kind of identified over the course of doing this podcast. Yeah, is one of the main ones that we kind of, well, the kind of the first one is we've already ticked off as soon as Harvey flies off with Rictus, is that he's ditched his parents as soon as possible, and you have to get the parents out of the way in order for the child to go and have the adventure. But I guess, yeah, we kind of quickly get to another staple genre of the weird house, which we've encountered quite a lot in previous episodes, like Paper House and Marianne Dreams. Yes, like the Haunted Mansion, the Casper movie, Monster House, not that we've done an episode of it, but Coraline is kind of a comparison that kept coming to mind for me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And Rick just arriving at the window is, I mean, he's not explicitly referred to as a vampire. You know, there's vampiric imagery in here, and later Harvey is actually a character who transforms into a kind of vampire. But it's very Salem's Lot like. I mean, before recording, Kat was sort of making some comparisons to Stephen King. He mentioned, obviously, comparison to It. This is just a few years later. But that seemed like a really Salem's Lot image to me, this character arriving at the window. But it's deliberately kind of underplayed, in as much as Harvey, maybe because he's looking for some adventure, is suspicious of Rictus, but not scared.
And I was going to kind of almost object and say, well, he didn't invite him in, but actually he did. He said, if I don't have some fun, I'll die. I'll do it. I'll die. And sometimes, like, we've learned from things like, you know, David Bowie's Labyrinth, sometimes if you say something loud enough with an intention, it invites things. Things are listening to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I definitely felt that he'd drawn Rictus to the house.
Yeah, so we come, this house we quite quickly learn is animated by a sinister presence. It's a kind of gingerbread house of a sort, in that it's kind of deceptively beguiling. And
the grounds are described as gorgeous, right? We spend quite a lot of time in the garden, and I really like this idea of the seasons. I mean, you'll get into that later, I'm sure, but the seasons obviously pass very fast, but it's almost like you get the best of the season. It's like the seasons have been distilled or condensed, so you get, you know, the most sort of bright and fecund spring, and then, you know, the most dazzling, relaxing summer, and the most crisp and eerie autumn, and winter just becomes Christmas. I really like the idea of the seasons being kind of condensed down to their essence.
Rereading it again, I was surprised because even though it becomes really horrifying, it really does. Clive Barker is the master of this. There's such beauty in the very small, because it the pace is much faster than I remember it being. But yeah, he comes in high summer. They go through a wall of kind of clinging mist from a very grey place. And I think it's called like Millsap. Like, Barker is great at making these hideous place names. Like in Aberrad, it's called like Chicken Town. Like, he makes these places names that you're just like, this is horrible. It's like, you know, Lurgan, or, you know, some place that no one would ever want to be, that no one wants to be from. But you escape from that, and it's high summer, and there's just flowers in the tall grass, and a boundless sky, and you have an open front porch and someone welcoming you in. It's the dream. It's homecoming, you know?
Yeah. And he's welcomed by Mrs. Griffin. He's a friendly old woman who produces all of the food that he can eat, and he meets the other children, who are Wendell, who is kind of goofy and exuberant, and Lulu, who has been at the house for the longest and is withdrawn.
I love the moment where he hesitates on the threshold and he almost doesn't come in. Because he's always shown as being like, he might be impulsive and he might be, he's a child, but he is shown as as having a way of thinking, of thinking about thinking, of being aware of things that is seems much older than, I think he's like 10 or something. But it's Wendell's, like, yeah, exuberance, like his uncontrollable laughter, his absolute joy. It's the joy of the children in there, because, you know, as we learn, the house is a house of illusions. But for a brief moment, the thing that's so melancholic about the book, for a brief moment, the joy is real. Like, it's just, it doesn't last.
Mm. Yeah. And I'll just read the description of them, of Harvey stepping through the wall. Unless I'm stepping on anyone's texture. There's so many textures.
There's a lot of textures.
Mine comes later. Yeah.
Okay.
See how you go.
Harvey did as Richter's had instructed, and as he came within three steps of the wall, a gust of balmy, flower-scented wind slipped between the shimmering stones and kissed his cheek. Its warmth was welcome after his long, cold trek, and he picked up his pace, reaching out to touch the wall as he approached it. The misty stones seemed to reach for him in their turn, wrapping their soft grey arms around his shoulders and ushering him through the wall. Yeah, there's just, as I was reading, I was just sort of, you know, putting crosses by just interesting turns of phrase and textures, and that there's a lot of crosses. There's a lot. It's just a lot of interesting
Barker,
choices. Yeah,
Barker words real good, you know.
What I really liked is it describes Wendell as having a spaghetti grin at one point. Which, yeah. Yeah, so the sort of the joy at the house, or, you know, is that you experience all of these seasons in a day, and like Adam said, there's sort of the best of the seasons, and the fact that, yeah, autumn is Halloween, and I think, I mean, that's, it's not there are moments of horror before we get to that. There are.
Well, there's the almost immediate death of one of the cats, which really shocked me. I forgot how soon it was. It's like, is it the morning after or something like that? It's very.
Yeah.
It's like it's his arrival, and you kind of see, maybe, I was thinking, like, was he the thing that changed, like, the ecosystem of the house? Because before that, I think the three cats had always been there as long as Mrs. Griffin had.
Yeah, and it comes just after their discussion about the fish as well, where it was Harvey and Wendell are talking about it being summer, and Harvey's like, "Well, is there anywhere I can swim?" And Wendell's like, "There is, but, you know, you don't really want to go around to the lake." And Harvey asks if there's any fish, and like, oh, maybe we could catch some, and Mrs. Griffin could cook them for us. And then Mrs. Griffin is really shocked by this, because what we learn later about the fish. But yeah, so that kind of really sort of quite a very foreboding moment is almost immediately followed by the death of poor Clue Cat.
Which is
they don't linger on it as much as they could, but yeah, something like a little sodden mass, you know, like it really does get you.
Yeah, and so Harvey does go to the lake and does find the lake quite horrible. But he sort of sees Lulu there, sort of standing by this sort of scummy, kind of fly-ridden, like, dark and dank lake. And it's like, oh, what's she doing there? But, yeah. So these are these, you know, it's, we're getting we're getting quite strong hints about what's to come.
And he's deliberately setting up, like, Harvey does realize that the lake is the opposite of the house. Like, the house is alive, the lake is dead, the house is changing, the lake is, like, stagnant and fetid, and,
And it's also, it's set up as Harvey being a kid who asks questions, like, right from when Rictus first comes through his window. Mm. Harvey's asking too many questions, and he keeps asking questions, like, random questions about the fish, like, oh, why would he have fish like that? You know, everything else is so beautiful. Why does he have this horrible, ugly lake? And Wendell's just like, who cares? is his response. we get a cameo from Pinhead.
Hey, I was delighted and alarmed when I noticed
this. An illustration of the Halloween masks hanging on the wall. One of them is the Pinhead mask, alongside various other creepy creatures.
There's a particularly evil-looking punch mask.
Is there ever a not evil-looking punch mask?
fair point.
So this is for Halloween. They get to dress up and choose a mask and go out and enjoy the spooky evening. And Wendell plays a trick. I guess this gives a chance for Clive Barker to just go into just straight up horror.
Oh no, the horrible picture.
The horrible picture and the horrible description.
Can I read it? Okay, so he's outside, he's searching for Wendell. He thinks he hears the creaking of a ladder. It was not a ladder he'd heard creaking. It was a rope. No, not even a rope. A noose. And in his hand, the leg of the man hanging from the noose. He let go of it and stumbled backwards, barely suppressing a second shout as his eyes rose to meet the dead man's stare. To judge by his expression, he had died horribly. His tongue lolled from his foamy lips. His veins were so swollen with blood, his head looked like pumpkin. Either that, or it was a pumpkin. A fresh fountain of sparks now burst from the firework, and Harvey saw the truth of the matter. The limb he'd held was a stuffed trouser leg, the body a coat spilling bundles of clothes, the head a mask on a pumpkin, with cream for spittle and eggs for eyes. And in the picture, the eggs are very kind of sloppy, yolky eggs that are dribbling down the pumpkin's woe-begotten face.
I think it says something that when I reread this, I just went, how do you get the eggs to stay there?
It's a great question.
Yes.
Egg tricks.
A special egg glue.
Do you remember... Do you remember being scared by this book as a kid?
Yes, but much more compelled. Like, I was scared by what came later. So I'll tell you, especially with my texture, like, it's all kind of wrapped up in a scene that happens later. But I was more compelled because Harvey isn't a Mary Sue. Like, he lies to his friends to entertain them. Like, he is mischievous. He does play tricks. But he also cries when a cat dies and comforts people, even though he isn't half to, and other people shirk the responsibility. So I think I found the fact that for moments he gets very, very villainous. The coming up scene when he has his revenge on Wendell, you feel the truth of it, because you feel how much joy you'd have at being suddenly gifted with power, especially if you have someone helpless like a small child. But yeah, I think that's why I always found him and Lulu such compelling characters.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and this, so in terms of him being gifted this power, this is when we meet the second, I don't know if he's called them really.
They're called a brood. They refer to each other as sister or brother, and they say loosely we're all in the same brood.
Mm.
But I guess you'd call, yes, we call them probably like underlings, henchmen, Igors.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've met Rictus, and then on this Halloween, where Harvey gets his revenge, we meet Mar and Jive.
Mm-hmm. Barker's really good for teaching you vocabulary, I find. Like, I reread this and I was like, oh man, yeah, I really knew, like, what, you know, and he doesn't pander. I know this is, you know, end of childhood, early YA, but just, it was great for, like, I confidently use the word quizzical, I think, after reading this and stuff. That's probably not within the normal reach, but he names people for their strongest attribute, or at least the underlings are named by that.
Yeah, so Jive is like twitchy and always moving, right? And never
appears. And Rictus has the huge grin, and Mar can change things.
Yeah. And the description of her is pretty grotesque. Unlike Jive, who looked nimble enough to walk on the eaves if the whim took him, Mar seemed to have slug blood in her somewhere. Harvey almost expected to see her fingers leave silver trails on the brick she touched, or see soft horns appear from her balding head. She was grossly fat, her flesh barely clinging to her bones. Wherever it could, around her mouth and eyes, at her neck and wrists, it collapsed in clammy folds.
It's like if you've ever had like a truly limp handshake from someone, like it's...
Yeah, very clammy description.
Clammy is such a good word.
Yeah. But she has the... she has the power of transformation, and for this prank, she transforms Harvey into a vampire of sorts, but with fangs like a wolf and a red throat and white skin. so just his kind of fantasy horrible creature,
but someone that could fly. I mean, the wings.
And he does not use his newfound powers for good.
he uses them to thoroughly frighten Wendell. Kind of.
One moment I was always curious about, because he doesn't take the first leap. I think Jive pushes him off the roof just to see if he can fly, and he does. And there is this moment of like terrible joy where like the moon like looks down on him with like the face of a mother, and he saves himself and he's able to fly and he swoops. So, like, were they just trying, like, if he, because you wonder about the other children and if how many times they had done this sort of thing to them before, how many children had been tempted, like, would they have just pushed him off a roof and he just, you know, got squished at the bottom and that would have just been it? Like, oh, okay, well, time for another kid.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems likely.
Yes.
Well, I liked the uncertainty and the fact that it's not wholly resolved how many children have been ensnared in this place, and seems to have existed maybe forever and certainly for centuries.
Well, for always.
And, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess the thief of always. And, yeah, they're, I don't want to give away too much, but there is some sort of redemptive ending, but you don't get the sense that, yeah, every child is necessarily saved and released.
Mm.
It's, yeah, it's all a bit uncertain, I think.
Mm. So yeah, that's the sort of transformation of Harvey, but there's also, here's a kind of another classic children's horror trope of animal transformation. If you think about the boys turning into donkeys in Pinocchio, the protagonist turning into a mouse, being turned into a mouse in The Witches. I think we have another strong entry into the children's horror canon.
What was that Goosebumps we watched? Is it Werewolf Skin or something?
Oh, yeah. We definitely, there's definitely been some Goosebumps in there. Yeah, turning into animals.
I mean, Goosebumps loves its transformations, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, via a mask or,
yeah,
turning into a monster, turning into some kind of animal, getting big, getting small. All of that's very Goosebumps. Yeah.
Shall we do Texture of the Week?
Yeah, I think we need to say it or sing it in real monster voices.
Okay. Kat, you don't have to. It's not, we don't make guests.
Well, thank you, I appreciate that.
Well, they can, but yeah, you don't have to.
Texture
of the week.
Nice.
That was way more fun as an on listener than as a participant, I think.
Kat, would you like to go first?
Oh, yeah, thanks. It's been living in my head rent-free since I first read this book, at probably slightly too young an age. It's going to spoil a little bit of the ending. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so spoilers from here. Yeah, hopefully if you listened this far and you're interested and don't want spoilers, you're intrigued enough to read it, because it is really great. I think all three of us enthusiastically recommend.
Thank you. Yeah. So when Harvey comes back to deal with the house, he at some point confronts Mar again, and she reaches out to change him, and she's going to change him into something humble. And he... It has kind of this line of he realized who he was and he was happy being it, but he asked her what she wanted to be, and she had asked him what his dreams were, and so he, in his turn, asked her, and he rejected the power that she had in her hand, so it sent it flowing back into her, and she starts to dissolve into these big kind of gobs of, like, this sort of slime. And she goes, I dream of nothing, so nothing is what I'm turning to. So it's very much this dissolvey slime, like, just handfuls of gobs of it coming down.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminded me of the other father... in Coraline.
Yes.
I guess maybe the idea that these beings never truly existed or have been created. And that idea of the being kind of collapsing into undifferentiated mush or slime.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really horrible.
And there's a really horrible drawing to go with it.
Yes, there is. Yep.
Oh gosh, yeah, it is really.
Yeah, that was the thing drawing. That really scared me as a kid. Like that, it was that, and the description to go along with it. But I mean, I read his work. I loved his. I've read so much of his stuff compulsively afterwards. So I must like being this disgusted. Like.
Excellent texture. Adam.
So mine was just a small vivid texture when Mrs. Griffin is first introduced at the doorway of the house. She says,
Harvey Swick, as I live and breathe.
He looked down, the weather vane's white silhouette still behind his eyes, and there on the porch stood a woman who made his grandmother, the oldest person he knew, look young. She had a face, and this is my texture, a face like a rolled-up ball of cobwebs, from which her hair, which could also have been spider's work, fell in wispy abundance. Her eyes were tiny, her mouth tight, her hands gnarled. Her voice, however, was melodious, and its words welcoming. Yeah, I love the simile. She had a face like a rolled-up ball of cobwebs.
Yeah. Yeah, and spider's work as well. It's just not... not a common phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I also went horrible with mine. And this is I don't know, as soon as we met the dark foreboding pond full of fish, I was like, oh no, I can see where this is going. and so it was. The fish do turn out to be the children who have never left the house. And Lulu becomes one of them. So Lulu had reached the bank, and for a moment the meagre starlight found her. All that Harvey had feared was true, and more. A fin grew from her bent and scaly back, and her legs had almost fused together. Her arms had become short and stubby, her fingers webbed. But it was her face, glimpsed as she turned back to look at him, that was the greatest shock. Her hair had fallen out, and her nose disappeared. Her mouth had lost its lips, and her blue eyes turned to swivelling silver balls, lidless and lashless. And yet despite their freakishness, there was human feeling in those eyes and on that mouth, a terrible sadness that he knew would never leave his heart if he lived to be 1,000. "You are my friend," she said as she teetered on the bank. "Thank you for that." Then she tumbled into the water.
I loved Lulu. I wish we'd gotten to spend more time with her, just because, I mean, they at least gave her he showed their friendship. In you know, kind of a brief period of time, he showed that she was smart enough to figure out what was happening to her long before, and perhaps one of the only children that really understood. And then Barker gives her like kind of the killing blow, like Harvey is smart, or Harvey is brave, but Lulu's like the smart one. So definitely one of the all time good like girl characters in horror books.
Yeah, they do. She's not in it for long, but they do get a real friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real connection between the two of them.
I think so, because Wendell kind of proves, like, we didn't mention it, but when Harvey goes after Wendell tries to get the monster as he sees it to attack Harvey instead of him, mm-hmm. by going, "You don't want me, I'm fat, go get Harvey." So even though it kind of teaches you there's like two kinds of friendship in life. There's lots of types of friendship, but this book kind of covers the loud, boisterous, like fun, lovely friendship, but then the quiet friendship that you know will have your back, and when you think they're gone, they're actually running after your nemesis with a gigantic piece of wood to hit them in the back of the knee. And I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. So we get this, so after seeing Lulu turn into a fish, Harvey is like, they need to get out of there. Him and Wendell, they need to go. And And they do escape, but they're set upon by Karna, which is the remaining member of the brood, who is a winged and toothed creature of
like a gargoyle kind of thing,
but yeah,
horrible.
And they managed to escape and get out, sort of pursued by Karna, and sort of kind of smashes itself against the wall and kind of almost destroys itself in the process of trying to catch them. And then they're out. And then we get chapter 14, which is called Time Was, which I found really creepy.
It was haunting. It's absolutely haunting.
Yeah. And I think this is a sort of another, I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but there's a certain sort of thing that happens and is in children's horror, I guess. It reminded me in tone or in kind of tenor of horror of when, I've talked about this before probably because it terrified me, in the Moomins, when Moomin Troll hides in the magic hat and comes out as a creature, like a weird looking creature, and his mum doesn't recognise him. And I just found this so scary. And I feel like there's a sort of similar kind of aspect here, in that it turns out, and I didn't see this coming, actually. I don't know if you did, Adam, that...
No, I didn't, actually. And it makes... you absolutely could see it coming, right? Yeah. It makes complete sense.
But it turns out that for every day at the holiday house, you know, for every run through the seasons, a whole year has passed in the outside world.
Yeah, it's a Narnia-like.
Mm. So...
Or the reverse, actually.
Strikes that. Yeah. Reverse it.
Yeah. So he spent a month in the house, but now his parents are 31 years older than when he left. And he knows that they've been waiting for him and mourning him and not knowing what happened to him that whole time. And it's... Yeah, it really, really gave me the shivers.
Yeah, it's just they kept his room the same way for the longest time, and then she said they finally redecorated, but because they wanted it to reflect the taste of a man. It's a real heartbreak. He puts some very adult heartbreak into this childhood story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they sort of, yeah, he doesn't recognize. And the illustration to go with it is also haunting. Of it's with his dad opening the door, and as an old man, and kind of with this sort of, I don't know, looking tired and haunted, and not recognizing Harvey. Yeah,
there's a quote, and I won't do it justice, by Terry Pratchett, where he kind of talks about the way you do horror, the way somebody makes something horrific, is you take something very, very ordinary and you twist it just a little bit. If you guys ever want to, you should do the Tiffany Aching series, because there's some definite horror elements in some of those.
Oh, good call.
When she's kind of caught in this sort of dream state and she thinks she's home, but something's just a little bit off, and it's that thing of, yeah, he's gone home. He's done the thing that should save you, and it hasn't.
Yeah. And of course, there is a similar moment in Coraline when she escapes and comes home, only to find that her parents are still missing because they're trapped in the snow globe. So she has to go back.
And it's a really, really
that's
good trope.
Particularly well done in the film, yeah. Actually, when she crawls into the bed and then she makes like her parents out of the pillows.
Yeah.
Oh, Yeah, sorry, this is completely out of left field, but there's also, like, the Silent Hill movie, if you ever saw that. There's, like, a scene where, like, they come home.
Oh, gosh, yeah, when it came out. It's been a long
exactly.
time.
Exactly, but it is the worst fake-out. It's if you saw The Descent, like, the UK version, like, the fake-out of coming home and then having it not be safe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really powerful.
Yeah, the TV series Channel Zero, which I really like, is a sort of horror anthology series from, I don't know, about 5 to 10 years back. That does it a lot, really effectively. So yeah, it's definitely one of the most potent horror tropes. Mm.
And I love that Wendell just shows up and it's just like, this is terrible. My parents got divorced and my mother's fat. It's just...
He's less poignantly affected than
yes.
You've got to have your comic relief character, I think, in horror. Like, you do need it every once in a while.
So they have to venture back.
Yeah. So they have to go. They have to go back to face the big horror.
To get the years back,
And get the years back. Yeah.
I think it's interesting they can't find the way until they've decided to fully commit to it, like, and then the house allows them to find the way.
Hmm. Yeah, and so it's quite a long sort of final battle where Harvey has to kind of beat all of the brood before Mr. Hood himself.
Kind of like a Scott Pilgrim thing, but in a different context.
Yeah, like the Elite Four. Like,
exactly.
He comes quite upsettingly. He comes back to find Mrs. Griffin locked in a coffin in the basement.
And they killed Blue Cat, but I'm so glad they killed the cat off screen, because I don't think I could have dealt with another, like, on screen cat death. Like, this thing was bad for cat deaths.
I like that, you know, it establishes once and for all that the brood really are merciless, because obviously they, you know, like, Rictus obviously puts on a fake smile, right, and seems kind of ingratiating and sort of friendly. So there's always that temptation to think, oh, maybe they're not so bad, you know, they're just doing what they have to do. But yeah, they lock her in a coffin.
But yeah. He gets to hear her story when she comes out. And actually, because I listened to your last episode, or I listened to, sorry, the maybe the one before that, it was the Roger Rabbit one, and there had been a comment on the horror of, like, being young and then growing old and becoming a baby. And this is almost the reverse, because in a way of... different things were horrifying to me rereading this than it was as a child. But Mrs. Griffin has this thing where she grew up and grew old in a matter of days. So you picture her growing old in the range of what actually would have happened. So every day was a year. So she maybe had just that brief period, like weeks of youth, and then she just kept getting older. And she did it all because she was frightened of death, and her cat had died, and she didn't want to die like her cat. And as an adult, now after the experience that happens when you've been alive for a good number of decades, you're like, oh man, this is hitting me. In a way it did not when I was a child and I knew I would live forever.
Yeah.
Mm. And he, and if Harvey allows her to cry, she's never been able to cry in all of these years.
She wished for it. She wished to never cry again. Yeah. And then it became, I love that all of her wishes became curses.
Yeah. Sorry. Oh, Gretchen's making noises in the background. I'm sorry we keep talking about cats dying.
The last one doesn't. The last one canonically lives forever in her arms.
Yeah. So we've heard about Mars oozing destruction from Kat's texture, and then next it's Jive, who keeps sort of making illusions, and Harvey's realised, you know, everything's an illusion, and I think Jive sort of implodes from eating his own illusion.
It reminded his belly of what he was made of, which was dust. Like, that was going to be my second texture. I know we don't get to get a second texture.
Dirt and dust and ashes. Yeah.
That illustration is incredible as well. Like, if you get this book, like, just love the illustrations because they're wonderful.
Yeah, it's very good. He's making his way up to the attic as he's, you know, beating these different broods, and when does he realise that Mr. Hood is the house? At some point, this is I think he realised there isn't a separate figure of Mr. Hood, he is the house. Much like the monster house. Kana is in the attic, who's sort of badly wounded from their coming after them on their previous escape, but sort of still being Hood's still using Kana to try and attack them, but I think
Kana seems like more kind of bestial, mm-hmm. maybe than the rest of the brood. Like, maybe it's easier to pity Kana because Kana seems more like a creature.
It doesn't seem to be able to talk. Is pretty much just something that you use as a punishment. Kana stole all of Mars' teeth. It was alluded at the beginning, which you're just like, did Kana then put them in Karna's mouth? Or did he eat the teeth? Mm. Like, what did he do with the teeth?
So there's this sort of claustrophobic, slightly wretched battle against Kana in the attic.
Mm. And Harvey defeats Kana through sort of
the power of friendship.
Gentleness, compassion.
like the sponge in It Lives Under the Sea, beneath the sink in Goosebumps.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
It's the evil sponge. I do remember the evil sponge. Feelings.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the way they defeat it is cradling it and and singing it lullabies.
That's beautiful.
So if you ever have a stinky bad sponge,
I am not touching that. I will microwave it, which I hear is helpful for antibacterial, but I am that is getting removed with tongs.
You're not going to cradle it.
No.
But I did kind of want to cradle Kana. Like, he was very good at describing this like wretched animal that is being forced to perform again and again, and it's broken and it's close to death, but it's being kept alive. And, you know, Harvey has this realization that all of these minions were just being kept alive. Like, they were, you're right, they weren't sentient, but there was a spark of borrowed life and will in them, and Kana doesn't want to be alive anymore. And it's almost like Kana knew that by accepting the kindness that Harvey offered him, it would put an end to him, and does it.
And then, so, right, yeah, Harvey's like, you know, I want the years back, and I want all the, I want the children. You've been turned into fish. I want them back as well. And Rictus is sort of trying to kind of distract him by, with these sort of illusions of saying, you know, well, whatever you want, have a, have puppies, have parrots.
All the books in the world from Aristotle to Zola was another phrase that stuck in my head.
What kid doesn't want to read Zola?
I mean, I kind of did after reading this, but I still to this day have not, so I can't have wanted it very much. I like how we're deeply in the bargaining stage of grief at this point for both of them.
And so, you know, Harvey realizes that he needs to outwit Hood, and he does this like through through like challenging him and saying like, I want it's previously because it's Christmas every day, so he got presents, and he got this a replica of this toy wooden Noah's Ark that he'd had as a little kid that got lost, and sort of, I mean, that's a sort of really uncanny moment for him, of him having this item back that had been lost. And so he asked for an animate Noah's Ark with where all the animals are sort of moving around and everything, and then he asks for like all the like a huge like meadow of flowers, but every flower is different, and he's sort of trying to wear out Hood's power, really. He asks for like all of the food, like a mountain of food. There's disgusting combinations.
Pig's feet. Pig's feet was definitely in there.
Yeah. Snail fudge with pig's foot clusters. Mm-hmm.
Growing up in the deep American South, I still remember there'd be jars of pig's feet in like one aisle in there, and I would always stare at it in fascination. So.
And then Hood's like, so it's like, oh, stop messing around, okay? You can have one final gift, and after that, you have to accept me as your master forever. And so Harvey's like, well, what do I do? And he says, I want the seasons. I want all the seasons at once. And Hood does it, but
can't stop doing it.
Yeah, it destroys him.
I guess even God didn't give us all the seasons at once, so it's a tall order.
Yeah,
I would have loved to have seen it though. Like I think I read that they were trying to make this into something, and I almost wish they don't, because it won't ever look like it does in my head. I love that he finds a way to sap the power of Mr. Hood enough to equalize things. And he's not a magical boy. Like, the thing is, he's never shown to have any power other than just, I think, vitality, I guess, or just that quality of mind that he shows. Like, people say that his soul burns brightly, but that isn't any power that he can use. He doesn't have the force. All he has is a bravery and I think the qualities that would make someone a good like fighter pilot, you know, a little bit of foolhardiness, a little bit of ruthlessness.
I mean, I think, yeah, it would be very difficult to adapt. I'd probably have to do it as an animation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has so much transformation and so much of indeterminacy and things moving from one state to another, which animation tends to be much better equipped for than live action.
If Barker animated it himself, I'd be there in a flash. Like, that would be glorious.
Oh, yeah.
Add it as another project, a fantasy project for Henry Selick.
Yeah, I do think... I don't know if Selick's too soft, maybe. Because there's obviously generally... I mean, there is whimsy in this, to a degree.
The cats are whimsical before they die.
But yeah, it's so. Yeah, obviously the illustrations are quite dark and jagged. And,
Yeah.
But we also get a good fake out with Hood, like that's.
Yeah, he's not. Rictus turns up and it's like, well, how can you exist when you know the power of Hood and the house has disappeared? And he's like, oh, I stole a bit of magic, and he has this little globe full of magic, which. Then
Hood carries from the grave. You know, the one hand comes up and just...
a hand with foot-long fingers reach up from the rubble.
Which is again weirdly. I mean, you know, maybe Gaiman did just nick bits of this for Coraline. Because
I mean, you start to wonder, right?
Like, because very similar to the other mother. Right, with the metallic hand.
Yeah, also has cats showing kids the way.
Yeah. I definitely think there's cross-pollination, like there was, I think, between, King and Barker, and, again with, I mean, Gaiman is provably, a man of his influences. Look at Sandman. Not much that's original. It's he's a good weaver.
That's a very good point.
Existing influences.
Yeah. That is really true.
Mm.
But yeah, so we get this remaining hand.
And this hand forces Rictus to pour the globe of magic onto the ground. So we've had the man house, or the house man, I don't know. Now we have a man made of house.
it's your classic Batman man bat configuration.
Yeah. His eyes are made of broken mirrors and his face of gouged stone. He had a mane of splinters and limbs of timber. He had shattered slates for teeth and rusty screws for fingernails, and a cloak of rotted drapes that scarcely hid the darkness of his heart from sight.
This man would give you tetanus if you gave him a high five.
Yeah.
I like the idea that anyone would want to give him a high five.
Maybe that's all he needed to be redeemed, you know? Just one good, solid high five.
No, he'd do a trick. He'd definitely do the down below. You're too slow.
accidentally seal your soul, soul five. Yeah.
And
this is where Lulu saves the day. This is where my girl comes.
This is
back.
Where Lulu saves the day. Yeah. So Lulu gets a heroic moment at the end.
And it's physical. It's not like usually they let the girl out trick it, but no, she swings a freaking 4x4 or something at the back of his knee when he's. And then Harvey grabs the wretched draperies covering his dark void of a heart or something, and he gets stuck into the vortex that happened where the lake is. So you're like, that is satisfying. This is a huge existential version of the person that goes on all fours behind the guy, and then you push the guy and he falls over. So
so then he's properly done in. And all the kids are processing out of the lake, turning back into children as they go.
All naked, just naked kids. So it's fine.
and And they all go their separate ways, and realizing that they're going back into separate time zones. Or they're going back. If it's all worked as they think, they're going back to their own childhoods.
Which means they can't be friends.
But it doesn't.
Yeah. Or can they?
Yes.
Sort of.
It is one of those. He writes so much about ephemeral things that are lost, things that can be regained. But there's a point in this book where I kind of started tearing up, and it was the fact that he and Wendell have a very good and friendly goodbye, but he holds hands with Lulu for as long as the fog lets them before they go back, because they know that there's going to be too much of an age gap there, and you know, unless you know the genders were reversed and he was Leonardo DiCaprio, it just wasn't going to work. So,
yeah. So we just get a little ending scene of Harvey being at the park, and someone's like on the place where the house was, and someone comes up to him who knows about it, and he says, "Oh, you know about Hood," and then says, "Oh yes, but he wasn't one of Hood's prisoners. It was Lulu," and she doesn't come over because she wants him to remember her young, but yeah.
Yeah, it feels once again like the end of the child part of it when they emerge from, you know, the tunnels, and you get this feeling like the world isn't perfect, but it's better, and they've done something.
It has a surprisingly sappy ending.
Oh gosh, it's the only thing. It gets real mawkish. Like, that's the only thing about this book. It gets are you going to read it? Because it does give me a little bit of a cringe. I did have like one single solitary tear that I'm ashamed of.
What do you think? Should we read it or
Do it in a fatuous voice? Like, you can.
Oh no.
Adam, do you want to read it in a voice that you feel suitable?
The last paragraph.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I said it's Dickensian in places, this book, and it really does sound like it's right out of A Christmas Carol.
Yes.
The days that followed were unlike any Harvey had ever known. Though there was no more talk of Hood or the house, or the green hill upon which it once stood, the subject was a part of every look and laugh that passed between him and his parents. He knew they had only the vaguest sense of what had happened to them, but they were all three agreed on one thing, that it was fine to be together again. Time would be precious from now on. It would tick by, of course, as it always had. But Harvey was determined he wouldn't waste it with sighs and complaints. He'd fill every moment with the seasons he'd found in his heart. Hopes like birds on a spring branch. Happiness like a warm summer sun. Magic like the rising mists of autumn. And best of all, love. Love enough for 1,000 Christmases.
And God bless
us. God bless us! Each and every one!
Yes. it's pure Muppet Christmas Carol for that one. I just see the bunny at the end of it. But, I mean, it's a great book for all that. I just feel like that could have taken maybe one more pass.
Wow.
But yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I really think it belongs in the up there in the canon of children's horror. And yeah, you know, with Coraline being tainted by Neil Gaiman being a scumbag,
we've still sort of got the film. Yeah. We've still at least got Selleck and his team's animation craft.
Yeah.
And it's especially hard for people of alternative and goth kind of vibes. We need everyone we can get. So we still have Clive Barker, and we still have Trent Reznor, and, like, you know, we've still got, like, The Cure. We've got a few good people that are keeping the lights on. I mean, the dark, grim lights on, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you so much, Kat, for suggesting this and for coming on the pod and sharing your insights and thoughts and memories of this book. It's been really lovely.
Thank you for giving me a reason to reread it. It was glorious. And if I can say anything, if you liked this, if you like his writing, read Imagica. It's my favorite fantasy epic. It's further up than Lord of the Rings for me, and I rarely ever find anyone else who's read it. And he is I'm glad that he created, like, Hellraiser. I'm glad he has that notoriety, and but Imagica is a masterpiece, and more people need to read it.
All right, on to the credits, unless anyone has anything else to add.
No. I mean, do you remember, Ren, that amazing pumpkin head Halloween scare? Do you remember when we tried to decorate was it like a wooden beam or something at your parents? We tried to make a scary Halloween trick to scare the children. We had a horrid, I swear, like some horrid bear mask or something. And then we had a cast of my teeth and your teeth, someone's teeth. And we, like, the teeth with the bear mask. Yeah, and, like, stood at the door and tried to scare children with it.
Good times.
I think we might have dressed in a boiler suit, probably, too, or something. Did you have a boiler suit?
Yeah.
One of us probably had a boiler suit, yeah. Or maybe it was a ski. Mm. A ski suit. I'm not sure. Anyway.
Cool. Thanks for listening. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com or follow
us.
I haven't checked the emails.
Of course I haven't checked the emails. check the emails.
Maybe. Okay, well, you can check the emails.
I've got no password for the emails.
I'm very good at this. You can follow us on Instagram at stillscaredpodcast, where I do a collage for each episode, and I will do a collage for this episode. Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, our outro music's by Joe Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Rate and review us if you want to give us a good review, because then we'll get more listeners, apparently. I think that's how it works. Oh. And don't get up to any egg tricks, creepy kids.
Leave your egg glue at home. All right. Thanks, spooky kids. See you next time, and thank you, Kat, again.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.